John's reaching his arms inside the barge to wrap them around his sister. It's a hug that he's been waiting 20 years for.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, and that's a scene from southern Sudan where the election is bringing long-lost family members home. In Detroit, a bakery means jobs for the chronically unemployed, such as this family, eating at a neighborhood soup kitchen.
It was Thanksgiving morning, and this man who I'd seen a long time, he came in and he had his grandson with him. And he said, "This is great. I'm bringing my grandson. This is a family tradition now." And, you know, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible.
And in South Africa, a proposed law would compensate traditional communities when their culture is used in stories or songs like this one. Around the world with the World Vision Report. But first, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, sitting in for Peggy Waymire. Early results from last week's referendum in South Sudan show more than 90% voted in favor of secession. One of the first challenges facing a new South Sudan government is how to cope with the huge influx of returnees. Nearly 2 million displaced people returned after the 2005 peace agreement ended the civil war between the North and South. And in the last few months, hundreds of thousands more came back to vote in the referendum and be part of a new independent country. That kind of influx would be a huge strain for any country, but especially so for South Sudan. It's already dealing with a shortage of food, energy, and water. There are few schools or hospitals. Despite all those troubles, there's also much joy as families separated by decades of war are finally able to reunite. Reporter Bonnie Allen was there for one such homecoming, and from the shores of the Nile River, she sent this reporter's notebook.
It's an incredible moment. As the giant barge begins to dock, passengers hang off the sides. They wave, shriek, and sing all at the same time. Their family members, standing on the shore, answer back. So I'm just stepping inside the barge here. It's packed with everybody's life possessions. I see plastic washing tubs, suitcases, cook pots, mats that people have been sleeping on for a week as they've traveled down the river. Everyone looks so happy. There are huge smiles on everyone's faces.
A young man, Allison John, has come aboard the barge with his brother, and he's scanning the crowd for his sister.
My sister came from Khartoum. I've just come to collect her.
When's the last time you saw her?
No, it has taken maybe 20 years.
Is she in here?
Yeah, she's here. We are still searching for her. But for us, we don't know how she looks like. Yeah, I just saw her on a picture since I was born.
So you're walking around looking for her, but...
I've not seen her face to face since I was born.
Like hundreds of thousands of Southerners, John's older sister fled to northern Sudan to escape the civil war. Now, like so many others, she's making the long trip home by river. In the short time I've been in southern Sudan, I've witnessed dozens of extraordinary homecomings. Sometimes sons and daughters reunite with parents for the first time in almost 30 years. Many don't recognize each other, but somehow they still share an indescribable connection.
She said that she was here. She was here.
He's shaking his head in frustration here.
We're
following him off the boat. So he's just stepped off on a wooden platform, and now we're walking up a hill. The boat's almost cleared off now. Very few people left, and yet they still cannot find their sister. Finally, John gets a call on his cell phone.
Oh.
Where is she?
She's in the small one coming, not this one.
Still on the river.
She's still on the river.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'll wait.
I will wait.
After all, he's been waiting almost his entire life. As darkness falls, the barge finally arrives. Is that your sister?
Yeah, this is our sister.
This is your sister?
Yeah.
So we're standing along the side of the barge, and they're pulling back these vinyl flaps so that people can literally climb over the sides to get off. John's reaching his arms inside the barge to wrap them around his sister. It's a hug that he's been waiting 20 years for.
So for me, it is like, you know, it is like I can fly.
John's sister practically collapses as he helps her off the barge.
She's very tired.
I'm in Ongbarago.
She tells me that she's happy to be home and won't go back to the north. She didn't like how she was treated there as a southerner, and she's afraid that southerners living in the north will be punished if the south separates, as it's expected to do. The family gathers up her things.
Most people at home, they're preparing traditional food. So today we are going to eat traditional food. We are going to eat, celebrate.
He invites me to join them, but I say goodbye. I know this family needs time together to be just that, a family. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Juba, South Sudan.
In South Africa, a new bill wending its way through Parliament could have major consequences for singers, storytellers, in fact, artists of all kinds. The gist of the bill is this. If you want to use traditional songs or stories in something you're working on, you're going to have to ask permission first, and you're going to have to pay. Traditional communities in South Africa see this as a chance to get recognition and compensation for the use of their cultural heritage. But many artists are worried that they'll lose some of the royalties they depend on to make a living. Kyle G. Brown sent us this report.
You had to be fast, and you had to be a great thinker. You had to have tricks to be able to survive. What's different? So what's new?
Regaling the audience in Zulu and English, famed South African storyteller Nina Malope tells the tale of a monkey and a zebra.
This story is old. In those long ago times, they were very, very good friends, two of them.
Their friendship raised the eyebrows of their less progressive jungle neighbors.
A monkey and a zebra being best friends doesn't make sense. It will never last. You asked me.
Lope performs this lively tale, dancing on a small stage at a woman's gathering just outside Durban. When Malope was a young girl, her grandmother recounted this allegory of alienation in which monkey and zebra disguise themselves to sneak into a party for horned animals only.
So he put two horns over here between his eyes. Monkey, how do I look? How do I look, my good friend? And monkey said, you're looking wow. They were so excited.
The use of traditional stories in South Africa may soon become more complicated. Under the proposed government bill, artists who cite or sample traditional art, lyrics, or melodies would pay into a government-run fund. The government then would distribute royalties to the traditional communities that created the original material. For Malope, that's where the problems begin.
There's so little financial support that goes to artists at any given time. And now they think that they can take money from people who are struggling anyway and supposedly give it to ordinary people. How are they going to take this little bit of money and honestly, without any form of corruption, distribute it fairly? Can they do that? I have big doubts about that.
The bill is expected to go before a parliamentary committee in February and is widely thought to become law in the coming months. But people in the music industry and legal analysts say the bill is unworkable.
Well, I think that it will make life very much more difficult for, let's say, record companies.
Owen Dean is a lawyer specializing in intellectual property.
They may well say, well, if we're going to go jump through all of these hoops to perform South African music, let's just perform foreign music, which is a whole lot cleaner and a whole lot easier to authorize.
In the past, people, many of them outside of South Africa, made a lot of money using traditional material for free. Zolani Mkiva leads a group representing traditional leaders in South Africa.
Again, people will take a song that is part and parcel of a community which has composed the song. Then people take it into the world-class studios to reinterpret, record the song, and then once they process it, they take all the royalties of that particular song instead of sharing that with the communities who were the first to compose that song. And we are robbed in the process.
South African singer Solomon Linda is a case in point. His family sued Walt Disney after his song, Mbube, widely known as The Lion Sleeps Tonight, was used in the movie The Lion King. The song earned an estimated $15 million in that film alone. just one adaptation of a song recorded by dozens of artists. But Solomon Linda died in poverty. Zolani Mkiva fears that South Africa's cultural heritage will continue to be exploited unless the government intervenes.
Whether it's musically or art, as in the paintings, or art as in the sculptures, all of those things, they live here for nothing. And yet that can create so much revenue for the continent, because the beauty of Africa manifests itself in these art forms and these artistic expressions.
Even if the South African Parliament does clear the way for a new intellectual property bill, the government will have to gain the trust of artists to collect and distribute royalties. That will be a challenge, as officials at the department that's likely to oversee the system are being investigated by police for fraud. Lina Malope again.
The thing is, there's so much corruption, it's shocking. I doubt that they would be honestly giving that money to traditional communities. If they could really, really do that, I would have no problems. After all, I donate my time and my intellectual property willingly to those rural communities anyway, without the government telling me to do that.
Until the bill passes, storytellers like Mlope will continue to give performances, both paid for and free, throughout the country.
And now there was even more music because many birds came.
That's perhaps one kind of recompense for traditional communities, until a more formal system takes root.
And from that day, it was never done, this thing of saying, you must stay that way because you look this way. You must stay that side because you look this way. And that was a story that Monkey and Zebra enjoyed telling many, many times from that day. When I heard it, I thought, you know what? I'm going to share it as well.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Kyle G. Brown.
Thank you very much.
You can hear traditional music from Africa when we speak with singer and musician Chino Bey a bit later in the show. From traditional cultures now to something very new on the South African music scene, here's this week's Globe at a Glance. An icon of the struggle against apartheid will soon be the subject of an opera. Winnie Madikizela Mandela spent years apart from her husband Nelson while he was in prison. During that time, she fought fearlessly to end racial segregation in South Africa. She was arrested, banned, and jailed. Her loyalty and courage earned her the title Mother of the Nation. But Winnie Mandela's reputation suffered in later years when she was convicted of kidnapping and her bodyguard convicted of murdering a 14-year-old activist. She was also convicted of fraud. Nelson Mandela divorced his wife shortly after his release from prison in 1990, but she has remained in the public eye as a member of parliament and a strong voice for those who still struggle with poverty and injustice 16 years after the end of apartheid. All those highs and lows make perfect opera material, according to producer Warren Walensky. His opera about Winnie Mandela will be sung in English and Xhosa with a 60-piece orchestra playing a mix of Western and traditional African music. Winnie the Opera opens in Pretoria, South Africa in April. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Melinda Penkava. More ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava. Detroit's image is pretty tarnished these days. Car factories silenced, unemployment through the roof. It's as high as 50%, according to some officials. So it might come as a surprise to hear of new businesses actually opening in Detroit. They're small ones, like On the Rise Bakery, which is trying to extend a hand to the city's most down-and-out population. Zach Rosen has our story.
It was 6 years ago when brother Ray Stadmeyer realized something had to change. He's a Capuchin friar and was working at a soup kitchen on the east side of Detroit. The Capuchins are an order of the Franciscans, whose mission is to live and work among the poor. Over several years, brother Ray served thousands of meals and got to know hundreds of men and women. And a lot of them, he says, were just stuck.
It was Thanksgiving morning, and this man who I'd seen a long time, he came in and he had his grandson with him. And he said, this is great. I'm bringing my grandson. This is a family tradition now. My grandfather brought me. Now I'm bringing my grandson. And, you know, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible.
About the same time, a local business owner came to the soup kitchen with a simple idea: to teach Brother Ray and a few of the clients at the soup kitchen how to bake.
There's a contemplative dimension, I think, of baking, you know, that there is a time of quiet, and it's working with your hands, and it's something tangible, and there's something profound about that, you know, that you can work on a piece of dough and finally see the product and then see somebody that really appreciates it on the other end. I think that's great.
Soon enough, Brother Ray's enthusiasm outgrew their space at the soup kitchen. So in 2009, they opened up their own bakery in a different East Side neighborhood.
Brother Cleo, good morning, good morning.
For the businesses around here, it's common to see metal bars over the windows and protective glass surrounding the cash registers. But at the bakery, it's different.
Do you want anything to eat?
I wanted a muffin if you had a muffin.
Yeah, what kind of muffin?
And I just keep remembering that time when we were vandalized in the beginning. And when the guys were putting up the wood on the window, on the glass pane that was broken. And people stopped in their cars and said, we're so sorry this happened. We're gonna really take care of this bakery because this is our bakery and we want it to work.
Okay, so On the Rise isn't just a business. It's also a reentry program. The handful of employees work at the bakery 25 to 30 hours a week. They live together in a house a half mile away. They've all recently gotten out of prison or a drug treatment program.
Thank you for bringing us all together once again. Thank you for watching over us all.
Every Tuesday night, the men eat dinner together.
Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Bless this pizza.
The house is clean and carpeted, and in the winter, it's warm.
You know, the first thing they told me, they said that we want you to get yourself together, you know, to think for yourself and to be responsible for yourself. They said, and then comes the bakery. My name is Paul Gibson. I'm 57 years old. I work at the bakery midnights. I mix and bake bread.
Paul grew up just 2 miles away from here. He was 12 when he tried drugs for the first time.
I would want to go to the basement party and talk to the best-looking girl or something. If I had a drink in me and a blow or whatever drug of choice I had chose to use that night, I didn't have no problem staggering up there thinking I'm cool and we talking, you know.
Decade after decade, Paul's life revolved around finding and using drugs and consequently moving in and out of prison.
At the time, my motto was, I'm going to get my money to buy my drugs. Either I'm going to be dead or in jail.
Here on the East Side, 1 in 22 adults is in prison or on parole. According to a recent Pew Center study, that rate is among the highest in the country. So the real challenge for the bakery is to provide a new community for men like Paul, so he doesn't slip back into old patterns. During his shift at the bakery, Paul works hard. He weighs out exactly 2 pounds of sourdough on a scale, or cleans the industrial mixer until it's spotless. At the same time, two of his housemates, Brian and Joseph, slice and bag more than 100 loaves of cinnamon raisin bread.
I'm gonna need probably a full rack. Yeah, I'm gonna need about three. I'm gonna need 2.5.
Edward Collins is the shift supervisor. He was the first baker to come through this program back when it was stationed at the soup kitchen.
I helped train the guys in the baking process, but also try to be an example through my actions that a person can be incarcerated and could be old, like, I'm 62 now, and also be able to bounce back, you know, and that's what I try to tell guys, hey, it's not over.
The bakery only takes on 8 men at a time. So unlike other bigger reentry programs, it can give each worker the support, counseling, and training they need.
Here, I came first. Not the money, I did, you know. And that gives you a sense of self-worth there.
Which is a good thing, because the $7.50 an hour the men earn isn't much. But with few costs, they're able to put most of it away. This program does not work for everyone. There was even someone who moved out of the house 3 days after moving in. But no one's being forced to stay or go.
We're not kind of dictating how they're going to do this. They're going to have to figure this out on their own in some ways.
In a few months, Brother Ray thinks they'll be ready to take on 12 men at a time. Some of them will be able to keep their jobs. Some will become supervisors. And for those that do move on, the Capuchins try to help them find something more permanent.
We have some contacts, you know, and some people that maybe we can get jobs from. So we really try to, I don't like to let anybody out until we have something for them.
I'm not going to tell you, like, I want to stay forever. I don't feel like I need to be watched no more because the program gave me the common sense to know to do what you're supposed to do.
Paul has come a long way over this year, and I've watched him progress from somebody who came to be part of a program to somebody who's a leader now. And that's what we hope for.
Sometimes I think they build me up a lot more than I deserve because I still see a lot of areas of change that I seriously need to work on. But they encourage me and it lets me know to be patient that these things gonna come, just keep doing the right thing.
Brother Ray thinks a lot about what it would take to turn the bakery into an actual worker-owned business, a place where the men in the program become rooted in this neighborhood.
I often think that if the guys started to buy houses on this street, you know, how different that would be. That if we could have a whole street of guys that graduated and had a firm purpose that they are, you know, about something different.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Zach Rosen.
You can see photos of the bakery in action, you can almost smell the bread, on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Earlier in the show, we heard that musicians in South Africa might soon have to pay to use traditional music in their performances. Our next guest has built his career and a huge following doing just that. Ugandan musician Chino Bey and his band Soul Beat Africa play traditional instruments from Africa for enthusiastic fans around the world. Chino Bey understands the lure of traditional music. As he told Peggy Waymeyer, it started when he was a young boy listening to the sound of music drifting from the royal palace.
All royal court palaces have a lot of music going on because there is always a lot of celebrations and ceremonies and functions and parties. So they are musicians who actually live in the palace and their duty is to play music in the palace. So growing up near the palace, I used to hear these sounds every single day and every single night. So
So I'm picturing you as a little boy sitting outside the palace gates. Or how did that work? Could you hear it from long distances or did you have to go outside your home and scurry up to the palace?
Actually, I used to hear this right from my compound, my parents' compound, because the palaces are always constructed on hills. And the music from the hills can travel like so far away. And of course, every time I also came back from school, we used to get back home at 5:30, 6 p.m. That's how we used to spend our time, go to the palace and see musicians every evening.
Really?
And then we used to spend all the weekends there. So the palaces are open, they have no gates. Everybody's welcome. And people go there to see dancers, to see singers, to see storytellers. And there's always food for everybody. There's always everything.
Oh, did you ever grow up wishing you could be a court musician?
When I was young, actually, I felt like I was one because I was always playing there. And it was my dream to kind of be part of these musicians. But you cannot choose to be a real court musician. It takes really a lot of effort. Most of these are musicians who have been playing music in a very long generation from father to son, father to son. So it's a kind of lineage.
Yes, man. How soon was it that you actually started playing music yourself? Yes,
man. Myself, I was about 6 or 7 because that time, that's when I used to go to the palace as a kid. And the musicians are always very open to letting everybody try their instruments. So every time they stopped to have a snack, to have food or bananas, we used to go and sit on their drums and start to hit them. And they were okay with that. And every time we came back home together with my siblings, we used to put together plates and cups and different stuff at home and just play tables. So I was very musical from a very, very, very young age.
What about school? When you went to school, did they have any kind of musical program for you to get involved in?
I was very lucky because I went to one of the best schools that had the strongest music program that time. And it was with my school that I made my first trip to Europe as a musician at the age of 10.
Tula.
Now, one of the things that's unique about you, Chino Bay, is that you play not just one or two instruments, but you play a variety of instruments from all around Africa. And I'm curious about how you learned to play these. It's not like you went to a store and got a teacher to train you on each of these instruments. You actually traveled around Africa, country to country, to learn about their music and their instruments.
That's true.
Tell us a little about that.
When I made my first trip to Europe at the age of 10, it was on a festival where I saw a lot of musicians from other countries in Africa playing instruments I had never seen before. So this really changed my life. I started having this dream that one day I want to travel to other countries in Africa and learn these instruments. Not well long after that, I think when I was 15 or 16, I began to travel, going to Kenya, going to Malawi, to Zimbabwe. And what I did was just to go without a lot of expectation, but just to live with the cultures there, learn their music, kind of show them my music. So when I did it once, it became so interesting. So it began to be a journey for me, and this journey continued for a couple of years. And I realized that through all this, I got to learn so much from the people there. They really welcomed me so much, gave me so much love, taught me so much music, and they gave me something that will always be a part of me.
Now, you brought some of the instruments with you today.
Yeah, I do.
That you picked up along your travels. What do you have with you there?
I have my kora, which is an instrument I learned to play while I was in Mali.
What is a kora, and can you describe what it looks like to me?
The kora is a kind of African harp, double string harp. It's built from a gourd. It's a calabash. And then the gourd is covered with cow skin. And then you have a bridge, and the bridge holds 21 strings. It sounds close to a harp, and it's a beautiful instrument. Yeah.
How long have people in Mali been playing the kora?
The kora has existed in Mali for a very, 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 very long time. I know from the family where I learned to play the kora, in their family, the kora has been played for 75 generations because Mali was an empire. So Senegal, Burkina Faso, all these countries around Mali today were part of the Mali Empire. And the kora was one of the first instruments. And it's more than an instrument. It was played by the griots, who are basically praise musicians. The music has been so much part of the creation of these empires from the ancient days.
Well, now that the suspense is built, I've got to ask you to play a little bit of the kora so we can hear. We know what it looks like. We know its history, but I want to hear what it sounds like.
Okay, I'll go ahead. I'll play a song.
That is so beautiful. It almost at first sounded like a piano to me.
Oh, yeah, it does. Thank you.
Did you bring any other instruments with you, Chino Bay?
I have my ndongo too with me.
Your ndongo. And what does that look like?
That's that's a very unique instrument. I just brought it with me in case. It's coming from actually from the palace in Uganda.
Tell us a little about the ndongo, its history and how you play it.
It has a small kind of shell, which is carved out of a special tree. And then it looks actually like a harp. And then it has 8 strings. And each of those strings is onto a tuner. And the tuners are made from banana fiber from the banana tree. And then, so the back skin is cowhide. And the front skin is a monitor lizard skin.
A lizard, a monitor lizard skin?
Yes, a monitor lizard.
Why does it have to be a monitor lizard?
Well, you'll hear the sound because the skin has got a kind of texture, and that texture is what makes the instrument sound like it sounds. And in the ancient days, it used to be played only in the palace, but now it's played outside the palace as well.
Well, why don't you play something from us on the ndongo?
Right, that's the sound. So I'm going to play you a song that talks about grasshoppers.
In a song about grasshoppers?
Yeah, grasshoppers and locusts. The song talks about there was a time in 1943 when a very big group of locusts and grasshoppers traveled and through from the Sahara, and they ate up everything and all the crops and food, and then there was a very big drought and famine. So the musicians made this song talking about this disaster, and so that, you know, their grandchildren can remember, because music is also the way they used to keep history, because there were no books to write and no records, and they used to write songs. So all the traditional songs today teach us about what happened so many years ago.
So when children hear this song on the ndongo, they know the story of the locusts and the grasshoppers.
Yeah, because the lyrics in the song are describing this story, the whole story.
Musician Chinobe spoke with Peggy Waymire. Chinobe and Soulbeat Africa have just begun their latest North American tour. You can find out more on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Keeping the lights on in Lebanon, that's next on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava. In Lebanon, they're worried about power, but it's not what you're thinking. Yes, the government there has stalled, and yes, people are concerned about whether that could lead to conflict. But in this story, we're talking about another kind of power, the kind that allows you to switch on lights or run a refrigerator. Lebanon is short on that kind of energy. But recently, its neighbor Israel hit an enormous natural gas field just south of the border with Lebanon. Energy experts say there's enough gas there to satisfy Israel's needs for the next 100 years. Lebanon believes it may also have significant natural gas reserves off its coast. Don Duncan looks into what this could mean for the people of Lebanon.
Lebanon has an electricity problem. If you live in the capital, Beirut, you're going to have anywhere between 3 and 6 hours of power outages a day. It gets worse up here in mountain villages like Ale. The government does supply electricity, but outages last between 10 and 12 hours every day. Ale resident Nohad Danios is watching TV in her sitting room. Like many other people in her village, Nohad often has to look elsewhere than to her government for power.
They cut the electricity in the morning 2 hours, in the afternoon 4 hours, and in the evening 6 hours. So I talked to the owner of the generators in the village, and he gave me a subscription for private electricity.
The owner of the generators is Wahid El Rayes. Tall and thin, with a thick shock of black hair, Reyes is known as the village glimmer man. Wearing a grubby anorak, he salutes village residents left and right as he walks around the village. Men like Wahid are a fixture in villages across Lebanon and in city neighborhoods alike. For a monthly fee, Wahid's 13 generators, peppered around the village, will provide you with electricity when the government can't.
Our subscriptions are really simple. We put a cable directly from the house you live in to this generator behind me, for example.
The majority of Lebanese above the poverty line rely on private power generators in one form or other for part of their energy needs. The government provides only 60% of the electricity the public uses, says Minister of Energy and Water Gebran Basile.
On one side, we have a deficit in generation, and on the other side, we have a very high cost of generation. And we have to reach equilibrium on both sides.
One way to reach that equilibrium, natural gas. It's less costly than the crude oil and diesel currently fueling most of Lebanon's electricity plants. Lebanon is pretty sure it has gas and possibly oil off its coast. And Israel's recent discoveries are emboldening it to explore, says government energy advisor Wissam Zahabi.
This discovery has boosted the interest of oil companies for the East Med. So Lebanon is keen on going forward with this because, after all, we're competing with the regions of the East Med.
Analyst Walid Hadouri with the Middle East Economic Survey says that if Lebanon finds gas fields even close in size to those being found by Israel, it could do much more than solve the country's energy shortage.
Lebanon is not very far from Europe. So if there's enough, lots of gas, they could start building pipelines to Europe. So there are prospects, you know, for exports, if they find enough.
And exportation could greatly reduce the country's suffocating public debt, currently at $50 billion. Minister Basile again.
We're not regarding this as the ultimate, you know, solution. Not only this, but this could be a very important factor in raising the country from its debts.
Minister Basile and the government finally passed a law this year to enable drilling. It says it will start auctioning off drilling licenses in early 2012. And that's not a minute too soon for energy-starved Lebanese like Nohat Danios, back in her mountain village of Adle.
The situation with electricity is very bad. If you look outside the house, there are three generators, and smoke is coming up from them all the time. I'd prefer to get my electricity from the government than generators.
And another reason why it matters, government energy is cheaper. It's subsidized and costs half what private energy costs. So with a domestic supply of natural gas, the lights will stay on in Lebanon, even in the poorest neighborhoods. For the World Vision Report, this is Don Duncan in Beirut, Lebanon.
Don Duncan has written a blog to go with this story. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Electricity is in short supply in Sierra Leone, too, but some people there are turning the country's lack of power into an entrepreneurial opportunity. Naomi Schwartz has this installment of our Street Vendor series.
In a makeshift shack, about a half dozen young guys take turns playing video game soccer on a small TV. They sit on wooden benches and plastic chairs, and as points go back and forth, the game can get heated. Other young men strain to see inside through a wide window. For less than 20 cents, you can get 4 minutes of playtime here. 22-year-old Alvin Williams takes plenty of turns playing. But he doesn't need to pay because this is his shop. And what he's really selling is something few of the boys, including him, have at home. Electricity. That's because there aren't enough power plants to supply the city. And those that exist are old and unreliable. So that means the power is almost never on. Shop owner William says he hasn't had power at his house in more than a week.
From last Saturday, it's gone. So up to now.
So entrepreneurs like Williams fill the power gap. The long cord stretches from the back of William's shop to an unfinished building next door. A small generator hums inside. Back inside the shop, the video game announcer gives the play-by-play incessantly. The game consoles are plugged into the maze of surge protectors on the floor. Williams uses the extra outlets to provide another service. For about 35 cents, Williams will plug in anything you need charging, as long as it doesn't block the video games. Most people come to juice up their cell phones. Williams opened his shop 2 months ago. It's a natural fit. He's an electrical engineering student at a local college. He says he'll use the profits from his shop to pay for school.
I don't decide to do that because I'm a student, so I have no facilities to pay my fees. Getting money to pay my fees, that's why.
He had to borrow $100 to buy the generator, and he is still repaying the loan. But William says he couldn't find other work. Unemployment in Sierra Leone tops 70% and is even higher among the young. William says it's all part of the harsh reality of life in Sierra Leone, which he describes as Bobo Pen, a slang term that means...
the hard life. So a really hard life.
But Williams hasn't given up hope for his country, and neither have his customers, who debate politics as they wait for their telephones to charge. For the World Vision Report, I'm Naomi Schwartz in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Chinese President Hu Jintao's state visit to Washington this past week was the first for a Chinese leader in more than a decade. There's been massive growth in China in recent years, and the country has emerged as a leading global power. Economic reforms have meant greater financial and social mobility for ordinary Chinese people. Millions of rural Chinese have flocked to the cities to work in factories. Those left behind often live in poverty. In a country undergoing sweeping economic changes, status symbols abound. Here's the Global Guru to tell us about one.
Welcome to the Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. This week we ask one simple question, just one, from somewhere in the world. Today we're in China asking, what'd that cigarette say?
I went with him and a bunch of the other actors who'd also fallen off horses to the doctor at like 9 o'clock at night. And first thing everybody did in the doctor's office was exchange cigarettes with the doc.
This is Peter Hessler recounting his time on a Chinese film set. It wasn't the horsemanship that struck him. It was the cigarettes. And they're not just offered to doctors. They're given out at weddings, funerals, in business negotiations. Hessler's latest book, China Driving, interprets the messages behind cigarettes in China.
The way that cigarettes become popular in China is not through marketing. I mean, I think in the U.S. that was a really big issue. Whereas in China, it's not the marketing that's doing it. It's the way that it functions in society.
They help establish social order or class or lifestyle. Hessler recounts this story of a villager with newly acquired wealth trying to buy a car.
And the dealer will never take Wei Jiqi's cigarette. Wei Jiqi will offer him a cigarette, he'll wave it off, and then he'll reach and take his brand, which is better. And he's sort of putting him in his place, you know? And then as they're closing the deal, he starts taking Wei Jiqi's cigarettes.
Hessler says there are over 400 regional brands in China.
You sort of notice this little unspoken form of communication that's always there.
Deng Xiaoping, for example, smoked Panda cigarettes. At 12 bucks a pack, they're easily the hardest to find in China. Hessler gives me some other examples.
Hongwei, which means red plum blossom, and that's a brand that's pretty common for somebody in the countryside who is pretty well off. Once you get into Beijing, you'd see a lot more city people smoking a brand called Hongtashan, which means red pagoda mountain. You have a lot of middle-class people also smoke Zhongnanhai light. If you meet a businessman, for example, they often would smoke State Express 555. And the flashier cigarette is Zhonghua, which is pretty expensive brand. That's usually about $7 or so a pack.
Brands range from 30 cents a pack to $12. There's a movement afoot in China to quell the rampant smoking, but the government has an uphill battle, Hessler says.
Nothing is really as portable and as standard and as easily understood as cigarettes.
In China, cigarettes are your business cards, but they're also about passion, desire, motivation, where we fit versus where we want to fit. Or, as Hessler puts it,
it says something about you that you don't have to say.
The Global Guru is produced in association with American University's College of Arts and Sciences and WMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Original theme by The Plush Interiors. To submit ideas, email globalguru@american.edu. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Thanks for listening.
Babar Ali is a teenager in rural India who runs a school in his parents' backyard. He's done this since he was 9 years old, and he now has hundreds of students. Jocelyn Wiener spent a few days visiting with a young headmaster and his students and sent us this story.
At 3 o'clock every afternoon, the children of Bapta village take their seats in various corners of the wide plot of sun-baked earth in Babar Ali's backyard. As chickens and roosters strut about, the children cluster by grade level. Many are barefoot, the girls in torn dresses, the boys in ragged shorts. They have no chairs, and so they sit cross-legged on plastic sacks. Today, the air is sticky and suffocating. In a few months, monsoon season will bring unrelenting rain. But still, the students come. At 17, Babar is a slim, stern-looking boy, a headmaster in shorts and sandals who commands his pupils' respect. He scurries from class to class, taking attendance, admonishing stragglers, and pausing on occasion to correct a student's pronunciation.
The proud peacock spreads its beautiful tail.
Babar was just 9 years old when he started this school, which he calls, in Bengali, Joy, Education, Home. His family was not particularly well-to-do, but his father was able to pay for Babar's books, uniforms, transportation, and school fees. Other children in the village, Babar saw, were not so lucky.
I would come home from school and see all of these kids not going to school or studying or anything.
These children, like many living in Indian villages, are too poor to pay the small expenses associated with public education. Babar would like to change that. In the beginning, he recruited 8 kids to join him. Every year, more came. Sometimes the students' employers objected. Sometimes their parents did. Many didn't see sense in planting false dreams in poor children's heads. But Babar persisted.
I was a kid. I just wanted to play. I started inviting them over and taught them how to play school. I was always headmaster. After a couple of years, I thought I should do something more serious. So I started collecting books and supplies to teach my friends.
Nearly a decade later, hundreds of children, ranging from first grade to eighth, gather in Babar's backyard every day. A dozen teenaged and young adult teachers volunteer alongside Babar, some of them former students. 14-year-old Chumki Hadra attended 7th and 8th grade at Babar's school because her family was too poor to send her to the government school. Now, every day, she wakes up at dawn to earn enough money cleaning houses to cover her 10th grade expenses at the local high school. She spends the afternoon teaching in Babar's backyard. The work is challenging, but Chumki refuses to give it up.
I studied here for free. There are plenty of other poor people just like me. I want to give them the chance that I got.
Chumki works alongside her grandmother, Tulu Hadra, an illiterate fishmonger who volunteers as the school's security guard. Every afternoon, she walks from house to house, gathering children to bring to school. She stops traffic to help them cross safely. Then she positions herself by the gate, so outsiders can't disturb them.
If they don't study, they're going to turn out to be like me. I'm illiterate. Their parents are illiterate. I have 3 grandchildren in this school. Their hope is there. That's the only chance they have. Otherwise, they'll be stuck in a village just like I am.
3 years ago, Babar's school was recognized by the West Bengal Education Board, ensuring that Tulu's grandchildren and their classmates can transfer to the local high school after 8th grade. The school has also attracted media attention both nationally and internationally. Last year, a California investment banker named Manjari Ghosh saw a BBC report on Babar. Something about his story struck a chord, and Ghosh, who is Bengali, booked a flight to India to see the school in person.
On one hand, like I said, Babar is a unique person, but I think the larger lesson is that it's amazing what one person can really do to change the society that they live in. Really, I mean, and in this case, this one person to begin with was an 8-year-old kid. If he can do it, I think the lesson is that all of us, any of us, if we really try and put our head to it, we can do something.
Ghosh has since started a foundation to raise funds to construct a proper school building. For now, Babar continues to hold classes in his backyard. Late in the afternoon, Tulu Hadra rings the bell. The students arrange themselves in six straight lines. Their headmaster climbs onto a small podium to lead the national anthem. Babar makes a few announcements, then class is dismissed. It could be the end of the school day, anywhere in the world. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jocelyn Wiener in Bapta Village, India.
And we end our show today with a salute to a Tanzanian superstar who died in December. Remy Ongala was a hugely popular singer, songwriter, and bandleader based in Dar es Salaam. He took his music and his role as messenger very seriously. Most of his songs were about poverty, inequality, and faith. One of his most famous releases is Mambo Kwa Soksi, Things with Socks. In it, he's urging men to use condoms to avoid getting HIV/AIDS. That was Remy Ongala, who died last month in Tanzania. And for this week, that's the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.